interested in the idea of your work as a form of transcription, and I've been very interested in the more recent work, especially this kind of the planches, almost as a kind of letterist practice in which you're thinking about the glyph as well as the image. When you went right back and showed the very early work from the 80s, it felt to me as if that was there. I mean, first of all, I was fascinated by two things. I'd say the sort of clarity and productivity of your practice, that you're somebody that continuously works through constant iterations, which sometimes are quite close to one another, and then sometimes are actually very far away from one another. But seeing the whole body of work, I found very interesting. And I wondered if you see that in your work as well, that relationship between, you've talked about an inscriptive practice, but it really feels as if from early on, you're continuously working with a particular form of representation that's almost to do with the writerly practice and the glyph and the repetition of quite clear images. I don't know if other people see that in there as well. And in the end, it's as if it gets pulled out of the practice almost completely. And the painterly concerns that you have in the 80s, which are to do with all kinds of different surfaces and textures, disappear entirely. And what you're pulling out is a practice that's very different. You start really relating to ideas about mass and repetition and the way in which glyphs or small images change themselves through process, you know, through the way in which they're kind of contextualized and recontextualized, and the different sort of preparations and transformations you put them through. Sorry, that's about all I've got to say, because I was trying to think about it during watching Mick's work. But does that set off anything in you? Or is that just too much?
It's funny, I didn't show... There's more than that. There's one series I didn't show, because I don't like it.
Okay.
But it's the most unresolved, and actually it's where I was trying to think of this notion of composition and the compound, and actually it's the way Warburg talks about composition. It's either the engrammatic, the sense of a compound, which is like a sense of sparking something off, and there's a very complex set of ideas around that, which I haven't really got anywhere near to come to terms with, I'd like to revisit. But what I was thinking of there was the relationship between mark, gesture, shape, image.
Yeah.
And one of the things, I didn't really describe it, but one of the things that I think what practice is about is two ways of describing it. One would be, that to me, an expanded field, in the sense the relationship of painting to volume, painting to depth, painting to space, is within this more, I think of it more in a almost Duchampian infra-thin sense. There's something imperceptible, which is thickness. And that kind of stands alongside, say, that idea of factura, which somebody like Bengt Buchler expressed brilliantly. It was like the point at which something turns towards something else, turns toward, say, signification, or the shape becomes something else. And those lines are very much things I'm interested. So actually, you know, I'm actually making reliefs. I've made reliefs progressively at moments. I'm now profoundly making reliefs again. What happens then is the shape is very literal. It's literally stamped out.
Yes, stamped out.
And it also creates something which is like a stencil. So I'm quite interested in that. But the earlier work, I can't actually look at it. I absolutely hate it. I can't really. I mean, I show it out of the generosity of my own heart. I really wouldn't want to put the ducks on the wall quite like that anymore. But what was going on there? There was a struggle, and actually, it's like, I mean, I couldn't really describe it at the time. But this, I didn't show any of my BA work. But I was at a Ravensbourne, which was a very in the '70s. I was there, which had a house style. It was very much a gestural abstraction school, and I found that relationship. And it was a lot of relationship to, let's say, late. Well, what happened over here, actually? You know, the relationship of Greenberg to British painting.
I mean,
but the the only, I mean, when I went to Central Royal College, the thing that interested me was an artist like Braque, who was always talking about the sign. He was always talking about, in a sense, visual complexity and how things, in a sense, turn toward becoming a sign.
Well, I thought what was very interesting for me about seeing your early work was, and I don't know, again, we can other people enter into this, was that it seems to me, and it's of course one's analysing it retrospectively, that your early work has the confidence that painting can answer its own questions. Now, in other words, it is extremely clear and very fresh, and then it looks as if you think that painting can move forward and answer its own questions. Plus, actually, you use a lot of kind of very recognisable motifs from modernism in many, many ways. And that idea of the stencil, the clear repeated image, almost Brachian images. But actually, the work also reminds me slightly of Lydia Clark, who's continuously using, you know, Lydia Clark's Mebius strips, the way she uses gesture, but the way she also interrogates painting. And I find the kind of referential quality of it actually as well part of clarity and confidence. I mean, I like the work very, very clearly, and I found it very interesting to see its development. But I particularly like the way in which you're managing to keep a relationship between, it's not just between signification, but different kinds of marking practice. So you're keeping a reference all the time to an expanded field of inscriptive practice, as well as to an expanded field of what painting can do. But can I open it up at that point? Because other people might also want to say things got nothing to do with any of that.
I just want to make, it's just in relationship, this question might be a bit redundant towards the end of your talk, because I was dying to ask it as you were talking, but the relationship to Warhol, and Warhol's relationship to modernism, and your kind of, you know, your early work obviously indicates your interest in modernism and flat surface. But then Warhol seems to be something that is a kind of trace throughout, you know, in terms of repetition, in terms of seepage, in terms of flatness and colour, it seems to be a reference that's constantly there and kind of unexplored. I'm interested in what that might.
Well, I did a show of Closer Than You Think in Paris. Well, I did two in France. And one of them had a catalogue, which something called Philip Armstrong, who was the one of the co-curators of As Painting, who I was working with in Paris. I knew very well. He wrote this essay, and he sent it, and he apologised profoundly, because over half the essay was about Warhol, and it was about pretext. And actually, it was very, I mean, it had occurred to me there were similarities, but the it's funny. I can't really talk about it that easily. He absolutely is at work there completely. I mean, that last show that was at the Haywood was for me absolutely extraordinary. Actually, in terms of at times looking at the films as well. I mean, at the moment I haven't shown what I'm doing. I was looking at Notorious the other day, and I'm getting screen phrases of certain images of. It's Bergman, isn't it? The woman in Notorious. With her binoculars of the race, for example. And I realise I'm appropriating in ways which, they do have enormous echoes. But I'm not sure I don't think I understand my own practice in those terms. I've got an enormous respect for Warhol, but I don't actually feel I understand my own practice in those terms. I think it's something I'm actually teasing out in different ways. I mean, the artist I'd feel more closer to, and I don't think it really comes out here at all, is Richard Prince. Mm. And to me, he's like, you can see there's a relationship to Warhol, Prince, but I feel I can understand my own practice. Strangely, I mean, actually, it doesn't really look like
that. In terms of the plonge?
Technology. I think he's got a much more... I think it's something that's coming for me quite late. I'm a very late developer, but this relationship between qualities of technology and actually what they offer up to reading, I think someone like Prince absolutely understands that. Understanding works with it. It's not a question of understanding, works with it. I'm not sure... I've never used silkscreen. Like Warhol... Mm-hmm. Does,
But Warhol's also a painter. I mean, it's when you think about Warhol, it also strikes me that it's the painterly influences there, not just the which are much more used to seeing in the US. Warhol's earlier you know, experiments with painting and his presence as a painter, the size, the scale, the interrogation seemed to me to be something I could see in relationship to your work. But it also interests me that, you know, how is one's work related to the work of, for instance, other painters or someone you might see as a very conceptual artist in some ways, as Richard Prince? Is it through the way in which the actual image and the images influence you, or is it really, as you're suggesting, much more to do with the approach and the methods?
Well, it's the economy. It's the economy
of
something.
Well, that's very...
I mean, funny enough, the other artist, in the moment I find myself coming back again and again, is actually looking at Matisse.
Yeah.
It's not looking, but more thinking of.
Can I ask how Patrick Heron fits in? Because, I mean, in a way, the early one seemed to be directly referencing, you know, the early... you know, like portraits of Tess Eliot and things like that, and that sense that the drawn that in the early Herons there seems to be a sort of a discussion between drawing and painting going on simultaneously, but also as your work progresses, it actually becomes so much to do with positive and negative, and what in a way. What isn't being painted or felt, you know, and as much as what is being painted, and that seems to sort of, you know, further sort of connect with Heron's.
Lisa Heron is. I was a student. You know, I was that, but the link is Braque. His early painting, he's completely influenced by Braque.
Yes,
I was extraordinary as a student. I was extraordinarily fixated on Braque.
Yes.
And it was that. It was the same. You were the Royal College at the same time, weren't you, Mary?
Yes.
It was awful. The ghost from was, but there was a sense, I think, in the 80s that there was such, I think, American painting was so dominant. It'd been so dominant. That there was this recoil into other languages, which were highly complex as well.
Mm.
And like Braque to me was so unfathomable on a certain level, especially the studio paintings, and actually, you know, that complexity of the works, which Heron was absolutely.
In your prints, you echo a number of those wonderful, very simple lithographs of Braque. Just to say, you know, a flower or a leaf or something like that, where in a way what isn't, you know, what's left blank really resonates.
But it's funny, those artists were, this is the thing I grapple with, and the word I'd use, composition is a word that got problematized really with minimalism, with Judd, the idea that it's Europeans who compose. The idea of auto-composition, non-composition, and it says works making themselves, like a Berlin freeze, or well, you can name it, you know, solar wind permutating, etc. This is something I don't think, and in a way, setting up a system which will generate the way a work comes about. It's something which I still don't feel I've come to terms with. I think there's something there. I think there's quite a big idea there. Which I don't think I'm close to it. I don't think it's resolved in a lot of. It can be resolved. It can be worked in terms of something like painting, and so I go back to sort of actually other things which come in contextually, ideas like Warburg, for example. I was in Venice a few weeks ago. I spent a long time looking at Veronese. And the way the spaces are unpacked and the relationship to architecture, for example, I'm finding that I'm actually accessing painting, ideas of painting, which sort of are out of that loop of a sort of modernist territory into high modernism, into postmodernism. I'm actually looking into some other things which I'm quite surprised I'm looking into.
Like what?
Well, very, she was, I was looking at Veronese by accident, I was looking at a copy of Veronese, which was, I was in a room with it, and there was this relationship of the figure to architecture, the sense of the positive and negative, if you like, the sense of, I was so Venetian painting, the relationship of gesture, things like Tintoretto, which are so based in literally the gesture of the figure, but also the gesture of the mark, etc. I'm finding I'm increasingly looking at that in many respects. Yeah, I'm not sure that's just there, so.
Mm.
But the filigree is what you're talking about with
yeah.
Braque.
Mm-hmm.
I think it's the term that got used with filigree.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I think I feel quite feel very long way away from all of that. I can't. I mean, strangely, the graphic aspect, though, is in my works being, I think graphic is the word I'd use, it's been really evident in the last few years. But again, I'm not sure quite how I understand it, because it's been there in various ways, usually through transcriptive process, so it kind of builds up on its own. But I'm at a point now it's become foregrounded.
But
I mean,
that's the antithesis of actually allowing the paint to drip at all. That kind of thing is what I mean. It's now much more of a sort of kind of controlled.
It's also entirely lost. The word comes to mind. It's what you've foregone entirely and very consciously, I think, is a kind of lyricism, if you like, which I think is very present when we talk about Heron and Braque as well in the early work. You seem to very deliberately talk about words like graphic and graphing. There's a different kind of exploration of what the idea of the signature is and of what authorship is and how you appropriate images and how you repeat them, how they become more themselves or less themselves.
Mm.
And that's a very interesting exploration, I think. And that's why, for me, it was also very interesting to see your early work where you're dealing with very different kinds of things. It is rather more lyrical and tactile.
I could ask if that... If that is to do with sort of the process of using the projector and things like that, that maybe a lot of those decisions and indecisions are being ironed out,
mm-hmm.
you know, in the studio as opposed to on the canvas.
Mm. Process isn't present, you mean?
Yeah.
Process is more. Well, it depends from like Sublime on.
Well,
this is where the composition aspect came. Is for me very important, and for good and for bad, is they make themselves.
Mm.
And I do set them up, so I know I da, 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 da. And they are steps. They can be literally formed. And what I've never been very good at is maintaining that. Well, I don't know, good at. I think if you're in a literal market economy as an artist, where you know they're not rushing out the door like fresh bread. You're not going to make that many of them. So what I tend to do is, well, no, Mario's got the same problem, is that I tend to, I set up very strict conditions for how I'm making paintings. And I wouldn't say they're rules, but they have very particular limitations. And and often there's like three band strands going on at the same time, which then will produce another production in a way. But in a way, I think they are, this process, I think this is very present, and that, to me, is where I'm asking the question. I come back to the word composition. I'm very intrigued by this disparity between non-composition, auto-composition, and composition, what composition might be, and what's going on in terms of decisions. I mean, the Nevermind ones, where they literally lay... shake down.
So that's what I just had to press you on that. That's what I had sort of working through the back of my head, was this relationship between the term composition, which came up, and the aspect of combinatorials. And the combinatorial, the selection of elements and their arrangement, because at some time you used the term engram.
Yeah.
And obviously that famous engrams would be something like the Kabbalah or the I Ching. The scattering and rearrangement of relationship. How far do you talk about the rules, how far are you prepared to say a bit more about that aspect?
I'm quite intrigued by it because, I mean, the relationship to Warburg, for example, that's where I came across these things. There's an Israeli woman called Adi Efel, who wrote a really interesting article about Warburg's, Warburg and Benjamin, and she's talking about the engram in terms of difference. In a way, I'm talking about depth and flatness here. She talks about a distinction between, in a way, the sorts of materiality that Benjamin's referring to in the passage work, and how Warburg's accessing the image in a... With Warburg, he's now talking about a movement, and it's a progression. It's a kind of steep curve like that, whereas with Warburg, there was a kind of a sense of an eruption. He's looking at these, well, that's why he was interested in collage, these disjunctions. So he's looking for a spark to come off in a way. And she was talking about the engram in the sense as like in terms of distinct ways of putting things together in that point. And that interests me because it just chimed in the sense that that's what I seem to be doing. Not really thinking about it terribly clearly at times. What I think I've been doing the last year to 2 years is really trying to pursue that more, not as a direct interrogation, but just seeing what the production is in a way, and that's why I'm using these relief forms with this rollout aspect, where there's a kind of conjunction between two relief motifs, you know. But I don't know. I mean, I'm fascinated by something about that. As I say, the sense of a composite as well, how that works. Now, these are questions in the way one would say, you know, they're the question I'm formulating. I really don't know quite how that's situated, but it seems to me it's one of the things I know a lot of territories of, certainly, I think, I'd say painterly practice, unless it's going to get into kind of very narrative genre-based practice, painting practice. I think in abstraction terms, and I'm not an abstract artist in one sense, but I'm using the paraphernalia, the tropes, the edges of abstraction in all sorts of other ways. There seems to be something which there's a blank spot. I think ideas like the engrammatic are very, very interesting to try and. I'm sure you know more about it than I do.
But there seems to be sort of that would connect to a broader aspect of composition. I think you tellingly entitled that one piece Riposte, which implies a sort of position taking and decisions about other aspects of construction and composition, in which be a kind of expressive density to the work along a number of different axes, in which this combinatorial element works at a sort of surface level, but there are other decisions that have been made which haven't been left to chance and arrangement.
I mean, in fact, they were called, the two pieces called Riposte. They were direct, I saw them as an answer to, and it's working in Paris at that time, a really small, very tight group of artists. One of them was Philippe Richard Rochot, who I thought, and absolutely dominate the scene, it's probably just jealousy actually, but who, I mean, actually Arthur knows more about it. Arthur was in Paris about the same time. Do you remember Philippe Richard?
A little bit.
And it's like there was the sense, I think actually the composite was something I was trying to work with. It's why I felt with a lot of painting that was going on. I think like Edouard Poulier, Philippe Richard, Christophe Cousin. There's this, the literal way I described this kind of colonization of space by painting. Which I feel very antagonistic to. I actually feel that painting has, I mean, there's a lot of French theorists talk about la retraite du tableau, the sense that, you know, painting can take in. It's not just about pushing out. And actually, that, at that point, starts to step into this sort of Freudian model of the beholder discourse, and the best critique of minimalism. In a sense, the only critique of minimalism ever took place was Art and Object to It, where saying that really what minimalism did was confounded the space of the spectator with the space of representation, and that he saw the literalist project, and that what painting can do, as I said, is completely ignore the spectator. It can be there despite the spectator. It doesn't have to embrace the spectator. And this is an extraordinary discourse, which art language use it, and without really acknowledging it, they actually dubbed it with the whole discourse, which I think is absolutely spot on in terms of what it is. But the riposte piece, I mean, it was slightly on a plinth, it was completely contained, and it couldn't be unpacked in terms of a sense of the way Morris, I think, talked about, Jack talked about the work being on an endless grid. It was, it endlessly could replicate itself. That you'd have to encounter it really physically, I suppose. Which, as I said, I think earlier, I think that's what Cubist painting was about, strangely, as well. And it's why I've shown that the Serra example. Actually, what I didn't show, which is much more important, was in that essay called Picturesque Stroller and Clara Clara. What he's basically saying is Serra and Smithson were setting themselves up as a critique to minimalism. One of the things that Smithson said about Spiral Jetty was that it was interesting how it got totally understood through the photograph, which he called a journalistic gestalt, and that actually the most valuable document of the Jetty was I think it was a 16mm film of the walk, actually taking the promenade, and that's what the work was about. It was about the shifting axis, in a sense. And again, I'd say there's a relationship, I'd say, within the discourse of how painting got closed down in around minimalism, in one sense. And then when it did reinvent itself, it had to use often auto-compositional, non-compositional tropes to do it. Artists like Serra and interesting sculptors and Smithson were using other strategies to bring back in other mechanisms of spectatorship.
Just on that point, I think I remember reading in one of your essays that in relation to the Beholder discourse, that the idea of the activated spectator is inscribed with the model of US democracy. I just sort of wondered what your thoughts were on that in relation to sort of interactive technologies, such as the internet.
I did a lot of work with this because I was working in Paris with Philip Armstrong, and actually Steve Melville used to come to Paris. He's an American writer. Especially Melville was using Fried in a very particular way to, in a way, establish a very particular position about abstraction. And the problem I always felt with it was that it always privileged an idea of actually very Greenbergian autonomy. It always had to centre, collapse around an idea of autonomy. Whereas, the thing about how Morris was describing the active and the passive spectator in terms of, again, European making composition. I mean, don't forget Judd, when he in Specific Objects, said that he basically trashed European painting and sculpture because you had to dissemble it. And he said this is passive. And the active is where you can get it all at once. And of course you get another chart about with Free, talking about the instantaneous. And this actually what you're getting with Morris, and it's what Close New Think was all about, was it's the automatic. What you get with the the auto-compositional, in a way, something that's just rolling itself out, is there's a kind of automatism that's inscribed in. And there was a series of essays around, I mean, actually, you know, that whole October crowd, but actually the one of the key ones was Deleuze did this critique of, I was doing a critique of Foucault, it's an essay called From the Mole to the Serpent, where he was critiquing Foucault as being incredibly nostalgic in terms of using the panoptic as a model for control and power. He's saying, well, you know, this is all very well, it's very 19th century, it's very Bentham, etc., but really, power doesn't operate like that now. It's a free-flowing thing that moves from surface to surface. It's about microchips, on, you know, all that sort of thing. And it struck me that there was relationships actually to Robert Morris. He was making works at that time called Blind Time, which were using. I'm not sure it's worth talking, but there was direct parallels between. I think some of these ideas of certainly the position of the spectator, but also ideas of, I think, how things are made, certainly in terms of composition, the automatic, the interactive, I think was being figured with, certainly was being figured along with minimalism as well at the same time. There's a sense of, I mean, Krauss has written about that, she was writing about when there was a big minimalist show in the Museum of Modern Art in Paris, that there was a kind of sense, a new sensorium was being created by the way they remodeled the museum, in a sense to, in a way, produce more relationship with these works. And it was, she thought it was a sensorium of another phase of capital.
We're going to have to finish quite soon. It's fascinating. But there's one more thing I really personally want to just ask you to kind of respond to before we do, and that's what do you think the relationship in your work is between writing and painting? Because clearly, from everything you said and everything I know about you, the essay writing practice is a very important part of your work. It's not just supporting the painting, and it's not just about supporting the teaching. Can you just say a little bit about the relationship between those things?
I think the failure of the education I had over here was why I started to write. Mm. Royal College, I just thought, was unbelievably bad at educating, just in terms of the bare minimum. Actually, my undergrad was better, because there was a guy who was a philosopher who would talk about Kant, made the conjunction between Kant and Greenberg, and actually could talk about aesthetics. And I actually think you've got to be, I really do rail against people who don't think you've got to understand aesthetics to be an artist. I think you do. I didn't begin to do that until I started to teach in Paris alongside Philip Armstrong, actually, who, you know, he was English, actually, he'd been to the States, he'd been studying with Donald Preziosi, and I got drilled there. And just by chance, I found that by writing, I could understand it better. So I was just being a pupil in a way. But,
so teaching is the crucible through which that happens.
Well, now, I mean, the writing has become much more complex. I don't do it so much. I don't, because, I mean, the writing I was doing in the 90s was like, it was like in-flight magazines, really, it was journals. And it wasn't particularly, I don't think it was particularly, it wasn't, I mean, I don't know. But what now I'm finding, I write, I use writing much more for my own ends to try and describe to myself what I'm trying to do.
Is it part of what it means to be an artist, if you like, part of an expanded practice of what practice is for oneself? That writing needs to be there, if you like, as part of making sense to oneself.
It has to be. I think certain artists don't, and they don't unpack things like that. I do think, though, for a painter, or if you're involved with painting, I think it's such a dense area at times, and that, I mean, I find a lot of painters do write, and they've also, they act as critics as well. I think they make often very good critics. But I mean, I'm not sure how important it, I mean, I do it much less now than I used to. But there was a time I was it was really, really very, very important, especially in terms of trying to describe something to myself. But like the last, when I was teaching in France, I organised a set of symposium with this teacher called Fulvio Carnaval. I actually found putting these symposium together was just as important.
Yeah.
In the sense that, you know, what text is, what writing is at that point, and how one's work is. I mean, I found I was really starting to understand some things through that. And so the management of text is also, so I mean, the last thing I did was edit something. Finding that, you know, that's quite interesting. But anyway,
just follows on from your question, is just how important the vocabulary of painting is in terms of the way you construct painting. Because the way I see it, you can work within the vocabulary of painting. You're very much placed within that in terms of, you know, your kind of resistance to, you know, the expanded notion, some expanded notions of painting, and yet drawing on from sculptural practices as well. And you seem to kind of draw a lot from notions of your composition or process, in relationship to maybe even to surface and supports and ground figure. I guess, how instrumental are they in terms of your own kind of construction of your practice?
Well, the point there that's important is ethical. Mm-hmm. I mean, for me, where I think it's what you're trying to maybe tempt out of me, is the thing I think is intentionally, I'd almost say, political. But so the beholder discourse, absorption, theatricality, is a, I mean, actually there's a conjunction. You can feed, you can read the notion of spectacle across that discourse easily. And it works exactly the same way. So I think it's almost an ethical position to representation. And so at that point, I think within painting, and I mean, Friedwood talked about the beholder discourse, well, it came from Diderot. Diderot was critiquing late 18th century painting and saying there's a huge distinction that's happening here. I mean, the critics of Fried would say that was a very oversimplistic idea. But the thing I want to salvage from that I want to find where the line is, and I want to sort of kind of see what's on either side of it. More. But for me, it's an ethical position.
Terms of your, because even from your early work, it's there. There's a sense definitely you're kind of embedded within that kind of practice of dealing with things kind of abstractly, you know, gesture or mark or language. It's kind of once removed. And I can, in a sense, I think you're also interested in notions of meta practice as well. So I think, yeah, I think it's evident in the trajectory of what you showed today.
Now, the last ones are called Bare Life. And yeah, that's a direct reference to a very particular discourse. But and at the same time, Bare Life, the Agamben idea of sovereignty, actually starts to unpack ideas of inside-outside, which very much within painting have had a very humanistic position in terms of notions of presence, etc. I mean, for me, there's a complete resonance, which I'm not prepared to... I'm prepared to talk about it, but I don't find it very that easy to talk about. I mean, for example, the other text to me that was absolutely fundamental for me in the 90s, it still is Althusser's Institutional State Apparatus, which is a complete idea of structure and this idea of obviousness, that thing which, you know, ideology needs for it to seem absolutely apparent. That's something certainly closer than you think was absolutely at work. That's why I was using ideas of invisibility, visibility, an axis which is used in a very humanistic sense. I would say, particularly in the history of, I'd say, British painting, still is at work, I think, and it's unbelievably ideological, but would want to evacuate all ideas of ideology. And you confront that, I think, in teaching terms. Time, that, you know, people want to attribute innocence to something that is clearly not. It's clearly over the top. It's clearly working in a particular way. So, yeah. Anyway.
Thank you. Oh, with Ben.
Just a short one. You mentioned Matisse, right? Mm. And you also seem to apologise for your early work. I would actually have liked to see more of your early work. I mean, and also you said you sort of, there's a graphic style in your work. Mm. I mean, to me, Matisse, there's also a very strong graphic element in his work. It's about pattern making and so forth. So, and Matisse also, in to make a reference to my own formative years, he was an important figure. And I think, you know, it's almost like a stern parent. They never go away. We try to push them away. We try to suppress any kind of influence. But I think they're there. And somehow, this is just my own interpretation, I still see that kind of Matisse in your work.
Yeah, I still look at him very closely. No, Matisse, I think it's still one of the most important artists on the planet.
And that doesn't really wasn't. As painters, we should never apologise for anything. Apologies are sort of social niceties, but nothing to do with paint. And we may disregard the audience, but we can never disregard those formative influences.
No, I mean, Matisse is somebody. I mean, actually, I'd look at it strangely, you're talking about other artists who have been important. Through another route, Matisse through another route, Kelly, Ellsworth Kelly, is to me an unbelievably important artist, an extraordinarily subtle artist who uses aspects of it. I wouldn't apologise for Matisse, I apologise my own, not apologise, I don't like looking at my earlier work very much, I really don't. And I make no apologies for that. But I make no apologies for Matisse, Braque, etc. were absolutely fundamental. And actually, in the last show that was in Paris, it was over here, the Matisse Picasso one, which I still see as a fight. It was a fight, and I actually came out thinking, first thing I thought, oh, Matisse won. And actually, in that sense, not to say that Picasso's bad artist or lesser, but there was something at stake. And I think with Matisse, it's something he maintained, actually right to the end of the cutouts, that last phase. I think, to me, that's an ambition I would certainly want to preserve as an artist, a sense that you can keep reinventing your practice right to the end and keep it as vital and actually as
well. That does seem like a good point to end on. I mean, I think a session which has really been about the pleasure as well as the kind of intellectual journey of painting, and actually it's great to have so much invocation of the American and European references of painting. I think it's incredibly enjoyable. I just want to remind you, actually, before I thank Mick, that next Friday, 26th, we have the launch of a book by another painter, Paula Kay, with an essay by a writing painter, Mikey Cudahy, who's a painter and a fiction writer and a critic I have a huge amount of respect for. And that's going to be in the October Gallery. And if you want more information, you can go to our new website, www.ikvar.org.co.uk. But we'd really very much like to see you there. And it's given me much more insight tonight into where your work is current, not just where your work currently is, but the depth of understanding of the discourses that you've been wrestling with as well. There's a great agon there, I think, as well, in the struggle.
Don't forget also next Friday.
And I'm sorry, I should say that
it's
in
all
fact,
sold out. But
it is all sold out. Before the launch, we actually have a one-day symposium on painting. And in fact, on the following Monday, a symposium at Kettle's Yard on creative unknowing. So we're really going for a kind of good discursive and generative discussion, I think, over those several days. And it is probably sold out, but if you are interested, I think you should still get
it. Is it sold out? But just to say, for those who
don't
know,
it's going to generate other things.
But it's across UAL and initiative. Actually, Dan, who's here, who's the head of Paints at Camberwell, will be talking.
Yeah.
Who else we got?
We've got.
We've got Jeff, Dennis,
Stella,
Derek,
Richard Dyer.
Yeah, and it's there'll be more of it. And Larry, actually.
Yeah, and the intention really has been, I think, to think once again about practices of painting across the university and beyond, and to generate a research group that's really around painting. And I feel really quite privileged to begin to be in on that conversation. And on that note, I think I really want to thank Mick for an incredibly stimulating and very, very, very rich session of ideas and aperitifs. Thank you very, very much.
Thank you.